but I'm just walking around, check it out now, you know, my depression just melted away and I'm like thinking straight, I'm enormously creative in the world, you know, I feel good about everybody, I feel optimistic about the future.
My name is Abby and I'm the voice behind the Evolving Love Project. In this podcast, my husband and I deep dive into the topics of non-monogamy and polyamory, drawing from our experiences of being consensually non-monogamous for almost a decade.
My name is Liam. Whether you're monogamous, polyamorous, curious, or anything in between, we invite you to join us for this conversation.
Let's begin. In today's episode, we talk with Tyson Yunker Porter. Tyson is an Indigenous scholar who belongs to the Apalet clan from far north Queensland. He's the founder of the Indigenous Knowledge Systems Lab at Deakin University in Melbourne and author of the acclaimed book Sand Talk, How Indigenous Thinking Can Save the World, and most recently, Right Story, Wrong Story. His work focuses on applying Indigenous methods of inquiry to resolve complex issues and explore global crises.
Our conversation with Tyson is a wide-ranging journey and flows in many different directions. We talk about the relationship structures of Indigenous communities, his honest reflections and critiques on his own award-winning books. He also shares personal reflections on his own relationship structure, age gaps within relationships and power dynamics, and much more.
For our overseas listeners, it is important that we frame this conversation, as much of this history informs and provides a backdrop to our discussion. The Australian Aboriginal people are the oldest living civilization on Earth, stretching back 75,000 years. In 1788, the British colonised Australia, and Australians have been navigating through the impacts of this to this very day. One example of this is the effects of what is known as the Stolen Generation. Between 1910 and 1970, the Australian government systematically removed thousands of Aboriginal children from their families in the abhorrent, mistaken view that the children would be better off living with white families.
Whilst there are many moments of levity and laughter in our conversation, there are also moments where Tyson shares about his own intergenerational trauma and the repercussions of colonisation on First Nations people. On the Evolving Love podcast, we want to give voice to people from diverse backgrounds, cultures and experiences, and we are so very thankful to Tyson for sharing his story and reflections so openly and having this yarn with us. And with that, we bring you our conversation with Tyson Yunker Porter.
Tyson, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
Yeah, thanks for coming through.
Nice Airbnb.
That's it. We just set it up. We flipped it. We've done the old podcast studio flip.
That's it. I like it.
Yeah, Liam's been in here rearranging the furniture and getting it all looking good. So there's been a lot of discourse recently around polyamory and non-monogamy being this like new thing that is trending, you know, and that monogamy is the oldest way and that, you know, non-monogamy and polyamory is this new age thing that's happening, which I find very interesting, you know, especially sort of when you look back at the origins of monogamy coming out of, you know, farming practices and land inheritance and religion and patriarchy. And my mind can't help but wander back to other cultures, other communities, you know, that were in existence before these practices. And of course, you've come to mind with your books. And I was reading a paragraph from your book. I actually read it a couple of years ago and I thought that I'd love to have a conversation with you. This is from Sand Talk. You say, "Romance is different in Aboriginal cultures. There is a word for it in many of our languages, often mistranslated in mission times as adultery. It is love magic, that body of law that maps the chemistry and lightning charge of attraction and sex. All are equal agents in this game of love. And as long as you don't play with anybody from the wrong kinship group, anything goes. There is no obligation for men or women to be limited to one partner for life, but marriage is still sacred."
Language is weird. I shouldn't have said anything goes, but it's not like everybody around the camp.
It's a free for all.
Sucking and fucking all day. It doesn't work like that. But yeah. No, it's it's a whole different thing. The danger here though is like everybody, you know, who has an identity or a something that they're into that other people oppose, which the polyamory community does have. Everybody wants to reach back into like a Paleolithic past to sort of, you know, like do a time travel scoop of some Paleolithic precedent for, well, this is natural, like this is what we do. Mm.
Just to justify the existence of...
That's it. And there's just a lot of... I don't know how people aren't experiencing more cognitive dissonance with that, you know. It's like, you know, on the one hand, it's like, you know, this is why, you know, we can't let human nature... We need control. We can't let human nature run its course because otherwise everybody's life will be short and no one will live past the age of 19 and you know, everybody will die and be killing each other and there'll be like one dominant male and, you know, there's rape, you know, etc. Yeah, so there's that on the one hand, but then in the next breath they'll be talking about, you know, evolutionary psychology, evolutionary, you know, cultural development and fitness surfaces and all that sort of stuff that's kind of you know, just edgelording around eugenics half the time. You know, everybody's doing that. You know, when you see it left and right, there's that nature red in tooth and claw on the one hand, and then there's this sort of idealized, you know, Hyperborean Aryan idea of a pure sort of race living in harmony with the environment and egalitarian and, you know, everybody with dignity and perfect self-governance and all the rest. You know, everybody does it. And, you know, you read Santorc. I do it, you know, a lot. Santorc is basically a cult induction pamphlet where I'm just using, you know, I'm just creating trauma bonds with a reader and then, you know, love bombing them and slapping them around until they've just experience enough kind of dissociative sort of states that they're going to inhale the stuff that I want them to inhale, which is either my culture's the best or like, you know, I saw this interesting thing on Russia Today. Yeah. So, yeah, there's all that. And I don't know. Love magic is a big thing, was a big thing. And then, you know, that sort of Christian rewriting of that is all like, you know, this is, you know, like some kind of spiritual roofie, you know, or you sing somebody and then you can force them to have sex with you against their better judgment. It's kind of like, you know, the pheromone spray of of like caveman life or something that our people sort of see it. You know, so a lot of our communities have that really rigid 1950s mission kind of mentality around all kinds of sexuality, you know, including monogamy. You know, so you find even a lot of our remote communities very sort of Christianized, missionized kind of ideas around sexuality.
And so before that kind of the Christian introduction of all those ideals, the traditional way of that the Christians would do such things, what is your understanding of the way that those communities would relate in terms of romantic relationships with each other?
Well, look, that's the first thing to go, you know. You know, so like I think I mentioned in Santorc that like the big strap-on dildos for ceremony, women be putting on and all these, you know, just these kind of trans ritual acts happening, you know, and that's the first to go. So the missionaries from my mob come in and just kind of, well, we want you to keep your culture, but we're going to edit it. You know, you know, we can't have, at a funeral, we can't have people humping the coffin. That's not on. We're going to get rid of that. And, you know, this whole role of sex in the sort of cycles of life and death and creation and destruction, and, you know, part of that big, you know, spirit,
So was there a way that it was
through connecting?
Was it kind of weaponized, like the view of Christians kind of coming in,
yeah,
and seeing the way sexuality was being handled? Was that then weaponized to kind of prove a point that Christians were like, well, this is just completely wild, or
you know? Well, it's a way to trap people, way to keep people sedentary, you know. So so Far North Queensland, the men weren't rounded up. You know, you didn't have to do that. You just had to entice women into the mission and then trap them there, or give them a whole heap of incentives to stay. And so then once you had all the females in at the mission, then most of the men had to come in. A lot didn't. A lot just sort of, you know, went, no, we're going to stay out bush. But, you know, 50 years later, they're all gone and no lineage, you know. So, that's how you do it. My dad was one of those ones who, you know, stayed when he could have enjoyed a really good life, you know, out in the bush. But he didn't. He stayed close. He was promised as a kid to Gladys Taibengumpa. I don't know if you ever heard of her. She was one of the big WIC activists back in the day. You might have seen photos of her dancing, bare-chested on the steps of Parliament House kind of thing. Or the Supreme Court, or some bastion of, of settler law. So she was dancing there at the WIC decision. He was promised to her as a kid. And so that meant they were essentially husband and wife their whole life. Although he didn't marry her, he married someone else.
And it's interesting.
So
that
he married my mum, but I still had to call when she was alive. I still had to call Mum Gladys, Mum. You know, and so we had that kin affiliation and link anyway. That was a mother child pair, no matter what. And they still had a husband and wife pairing, in that way in the law, because promise. Wife, wow. Etc. It's like that. But, you know, promised wife doesn't mean you're limited just to that person, you know. He married someone else. Mum Hersey. That's, I don't know. You talk to old ladies, you know, and they're like, they'll be looking around, they'll see some young fella and they go, oh, yeah, I like him. I think, this husband I got right now, he's been good for about 6 months, but I think I'm going to move on to that.
That'll be Abby.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
And there isn't that kind of disgust about age disparity kind of thing. Like, you know, a young fella all happily, like, you know, shack up with an older woman who's got, you know, a beard.
Yeah.
Old age as well. Yeah, it's kind of, I don't know, it's a different thing. It's different beauty standards, different standards of attraction. Mm-hmm. It's about who you're supposed to be attracted to in the kinship system, you know. There's a whole category in the kinship system of, well, these are the people that you have sex with, you know, over here, but not these people over here. You got an avoidance relationship with them. And that's like death. You don't do that.
Yeah.
Because with small populations, there has to be a genetic algorithm running that maintains genetic vigor with a small population. And so you have this kinship system that makes sure, you know, that those pairings, those biological pairings will come around like every third time or whatever to make sure that genetic vigor is enhanced, not diminished, you know. So that's why that's like iron law there. So you can't just go with anybody, you know, and there are obligations.
Yeah, for sure. That makes complete sense. Just making sure that there isn't sort of, you know, any, you know, sort of incest things happening, and people will be well, you know, if their babies will come, you know, when people are having sex. So within these kinship groups, so even if people were married, were they still able to be with the other people from the approved kinship group? Or not? Is that sort of pre-marriage?
No. It's like that. And even when you meet with other groups, there's kinship systems are different, but the pattern's still there. So I'm scaly person, like, I don't know, you know, bearded dragon or frilly lizard. So I might not go with this kookaburra woman, you know, or something like that. So it's, there's a lot of rules as well. It's not like anything goes, but you know, it's, you regard, so, I mean, as much as I dislike my woman's ex, he's like a white fella, my stepdaughter's dad. It's like, you know, he doesn't like me, obviously, because I'm with his woman, you know. And so we got that tension and we almost never speak, but I still call him my brother. And if my kids are around when he's sort of, comes by to drop something off or pick up the girl, you know, I say hello to uncle, you know, because that's what that is. Even though he's like a settler, it's like, you know, in my mind, he belongs in that group, you know. So that's just how that goes. And him and me, you know, as brothers, we would have that relation with all this group of women over here who we can have sex with. We can, you know, and we might go with each other's partners. Our partners might switch around too. They might, you know, look over there and I want this other brother. He's got nice abs, you know. might go like that. You know, it's kind of fluid in that way, but at the same time, really, it's the same as all like anarchist, no boss governance systems. It's like, you know, everybody's free and sovereign, but there are more rules than in a authoritarian government. Even it's just like, but it's just that the policing of those rules, that power and authority is distributed, you know, throughout the group more, and everybody polices these things. So you look straight away if somebody's making like, yeah, Maric, like they're making love eyes over there. Everybody knows me and one chucky and he's like going for a woman there. But if, you know, there's love eyes from, no, that's wrong. wrong way there. Like, you can't be looking over at that mob like that, you know, and then, and then they'll get shamed and usually it'll stop there. But if it doesn't stop there, then there's, you know, there'll be fights, there'll be stuff like that. Old days, they might get speared or something like that. Half our dreaming stories about someone going the wrong way. You know, like, you know, water rat and duck. You know, water rat and duck, and they're not those groups. In those clans, they're not even allowed to look at each other. They got a nice relationship.
Right. So there's more freedom, you know, outside of the monogamous perspective, but it's still very organized. It's not anything goes.
That's it. It's not anything goes. But when it does, it's like really an abomination. So water rat and duck did get together, and there's different versions about with varying degrees of consent in the story going on. But the abomination that was produced from that union was the platypus, you know. So that's how that goes. That platypus, then, you know, it took a really long time for the platypus to become its own kind of sacred totemic entity and, you know, have a place in the world too. They were kind of outcasts for a long time wandering, and that's how all that platypus song line spread out.
Yeah, there are still consequences. The story that shows what can happen when you know, you do go the way that you're not meant to go. Yeah. And I feel like, you know, for Liam and I, people, when we first tell people that we are non-monogamous, some people think, oh, wow, does that mean like you've got no rules and you're just free agents just in the world?
It's
you know, do anything you want all of the time. And we're like, well, no, of course not. Like, we just have our own, you know, set of arrangements and agreements that work really well for us and for the people who we're also in connection with.
You might be like, I hate that bitch over there, you know. She's always looking to, you know, passive aggressive attack me. Like, do not fuck that girl. She's going to, like, use it against me, you know. Like, there's lots of different, you know, relations to manage. And that's, like, old as time, that one.
For sure.
Have you come across Kim Tallbear?
No.
Oh, you got to get her on.
Okay.
So Native American, Kim Tallbear. A lot of her scholarship, she's a Native American scholar. A lot of her scholarship is around polyamory.
Amazing.
And you know, sexuality and all those precedents in Indigenous law there.
Yeah.
She talks about sex as embassy.
Yeah.
Which is okay. really important, you know, so when different groups will be meeting for, you know, embassy, powwow, whatever you want to call it, you know, there's a whole heap of stuff you do first.
Like a ritualistic type thing.
Yeah, to come into relation. Mm-hmm. And that might often involve, you know, having sex because it completely eradicates the boundaries between you and the it establishes trust. It creates a relational space where you already know each other's bodies and minds before you start talking.
Mm.
So she talks about that as like a ritual protocol in embassy.
Because it also strengthens kind of the group as well, like as a whole.
Yeah.
If like, you know, we had Chris Ryan on recently who talked about, you know, these types of things like over the course of history and that sense of kind of adding to social cohesion. If you're kind of all relating with each other in this way, there is that sense of like, oh, I'm looking after this person's, you know, wife as well because, you know, I've had relations with her, and it kind of brings the community together in this kind of interesting way.
And I don't know. So me and my woman, we sort of find, you know, if you're, I don't know, you're living in a sort of hostile world that's hostile to you. And so you need to create like, you know, not even like an impermeable sort of boundary around yourself protectively. And so that monogamous thing works for us. I mean, it also works because just in our chemistry, you know, it's like, you know, oh, so what's your sexuality? It's like, well, her name's Meg. So I'm like megrosexual, you know? It's like any of my romantic or, you know, physical, biological thoughts are always directed to her. And if I, down the street and I feel someone pulling my eye towards them, I'll be like, no, you're not going to get me. I'll flick my head around. Or sometimes I get stuck and then notice, oh, no, I'm staring, like, stop it. You know, because it's, I don't know, it's a way people can get a foot in the door and harm you, you know, when the world's hostile like that. So I guess it depends how hypervigilant you are. You would have to feel very comfortable in your community. Like when you guys made the transition from, you know, New York polyamory community to back to Australia, that must have been a, you know, there must have been a tightening of things there when you got back due to the sort of hostility.
Oh, absolutely. We were incredibly private about our non-monogamy. We, you know, of course, we didn't want to be judged. We're parents. We also have, you know, we have so much care and respect for our love. We also feel protective of our love. So I was self-conscious for friends to be, you know, judging our connection just because we are non-monogamous.
Yeah.
So we were incredibly private about it. And then it was just gradually sharing a little bit more about it. We began to feel more comfortable. But it is really interesting, you know, the conversation around what is still, you know, left for us as a couple. Because, you know, for Liam and I, we feel very, you know, bonded with our, you know, with the way that we communicate. And also, you know, non-monogamy works for us because we do have, you know, we do feel compersion. So, you know, as where the most common feeling might be jealousy or fear, it's like, you know, for Liam to receive attention or connection from another woman, it's like that actually sparks a desire in me that makes me like more into him.
Yeah, get so that. Somebody else likes him.
Yeah. It's like that's a sweet
because otherwise
that's
he's just
spot.
This fella hanging around.
Or else it's or
he's
else
got
it's
no
weird.
Belly fat too. You've got like a new baby, and where's all his estrogen? It's
Who
gone.
Knows? Who knows, mate?
You know what I mean? Because we get estrogen like when there's a baby, like heaps of it.
Yeah,
and then
we get
pregnancy,
we get fat, and you know, and like we hang around. And she's just not into it. And then you're just this slob and it's like, nobody wants him.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing because for us, it actually, by being non-monogamous and having that openness to other people actually ups our desire for each other. So
I got to do some sit-ups. I got to remain competitive in this marriage.
It's a fascinating thing. But it's like, you know, of course, with saying that, you know, I'm still so protective of Liam. Yeah. And I still say, you know, he is my husband. He is my man.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is also controversial to say in the polyamorous space because, you know, everybody is meant to be 100% their own person.
Got to be anarchist.
Very anarchist, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Very egalitarian utopia, you know, as you were saying earlier. But, you know, for us, it's like I still have all of those feelings of protection and then being very wary of, well, who will be, you know, who are the women that are going to be connecting in with Liam? I have to have that deep sense of camaraderie. And one of the most amazing and fascinating things about non-monogamy has actually been some of the deep platonic friendships that I have made with the women who Liam has dated that look so different to what society would tell us our relationship should be. We should be in competition. We should be against each other.
That's because they're your sisters and cousins, you know?
Exactly. Mm. We have a connection, you know, and even, you know, the partners of, you know, if there's been another man that I've dated and he has another partner, the connection that I feel with her because we actually have a person in common who we care about.
That's it.
So it's incredibly fascinating and it goes very much against these religious ideals of what a marriage should be.
Yeah. But also that individualistic sense of like it's all about me. Like, you know, it's actually viewing kind of relationships more as community.
It's a relational web.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. So it's not, you know, a lot of people misuse the word anarchy. Like anarchy got rules. There's a structure more than anything.
Mm.
It's a whole heap of nested, you know, sort of concentric circles of relationships that are intensely rule governed. You know, it's and the governance is distributed, but it's really rule governed. You know, it's not chaos. You know, that's people mistake that. That's libertarianism. Mm. You know, and which is a different thing. There's still a sense of community, but it's like it's me. Mm. You know, I choose. You know, everything, but you know, sometimes you can't choose. Are you in relation with, and you know, you got to do your best with it. You know, and you still have to respect him, you know, everybody, or you end up, whole thing falls apart.
Mm.
Yeah. So that's not anarchy. Like you're doing anarchy, but then ones who are like, oh no, it's, you know, got to be anarchy, like just constant, you know, everybody shagging everybody no matter what. That's not anarchy.
No.
Yeah, that's libertarianism. Mm. Libertarian sexuality.
Mm.
Although weirdly most libertarians are like, you know, really insistent on monogamy and or polygamy in favor of the man.
Yeah, like the man with the harem of women and the wife is like feeding the husband lovers or something.
Yeah, no, we messed up.
That's definitely not us.
But to loop in your book, your wonderful book, Right Story, Wrong Story.
Yeah.
In that you talk about, maybe the best thing would be for you to define or kind of like explain a little bit about what you mean by right story, wrong story.
So, well, right story takes time and it's like a, you know, collective process that takes place over more deep time, you know, relationships, and it's grounded in law.
Mm.
You know, I mean, it's adaptive, but slowly adaptive, you know, over time. But it's never unilateral. See, the unilateral thing, that's wrong story.
Mm.
That's where you would either pervert the folklore or the law that's at the basis, you know. You either pervert that and twist it to your own needs or you create new story, you know, that's... that has an opposite aim to what it claims, you know, or it has hidden aims or little secret codes where you're signaling, you know, people who are shitty people, you know. We mentioned Barry Weiss before we started doing this. Yeah. Lots of wrong story there, you know. So wrong story, you know, all these people, like this idea, I used to be a liberal, but, you know, I used to be progressive, but now I just can't stand all this woke madness. You know, so now I'm a contrarian centrist and it's like, no, you're just a queer fascist. Like, you know, and you're just getting heaps of support because you're, you know, seemingly from a demographic that, you know, the alt-right and, you know, Christo-fascist right hates, but, you know, they like to have you around so they could say, see,
we're he's one of truly us inclusive. He's one of us. Yeah.
You're the racists. You know? yeah. you're the bigots because you don't like Barry Wise. Yeah, that's wrong story, you know. Mm. And that's a story that's told over and over again. You see that a lot of influencers, and especially like on the left, people find that they can get a bigger audience if they game and go over to the right and just let their privilege off the leash. You know, a bit. It's emotionally satisfying to their ego, but then at the same time, like, you're gonna like triple your audience in a week, you know, if you do that, and then that'll grow exponentially over time.
Because there is that sense that kind of wrong story feels like it can happen really quickly.
Yeah.
You know, but right story, it feels like there is this, as you were saying, this sense of it needs to be consensus.
Yeah.
And sometimes consensus can take just a really long time.
Well, look, evolution is a thing, you know. Evolution is adaptive, but in response to context, you know, in response to land, how the land's moving, that's moving everything in that system in patterns that's evolving them all the time. And you, so, and that applies to culture as well. Culture evolves. It's a freaking slow process though, you know. Takes like, you know, long time, takes like 500 to 800 years for humans anyway, with our breeding cycle, you know. With birds, it's quicker. You know, because they're banging out a new one every year. With bacteria, it's just like you can watch it happen over an hour. So you got those evolutionary pressures are happening all the time, and that's just how things are. And right story evolves like responsively, and you know, you end up with a whole heap of different nodes. Different. What I'd say nodes, but you know, are different individuals, you know, within that system who are all responding to the evolutionary pressure in different ways. So you get this real spread, this real kind of bell curve thing happening. But it's not just the average in the center that's driving the evolution; it's the outliers too. You know, the negative ones at that end of the bell curve, and then you know, outliers are interesting because they're the ones who spark stuff. And
because I think you talk about the bowl in the book, right? And at the edges of the bowl,
yeah, that's it.
Yeah,
that's not me. No, that was a like a finance biomimicry.
Oh, okay.
Guru.
Oh, Catherine.
Catherine. Yeah, she keeps bees, and so a lot of her biomimicry stuff is around bees. Yeah. So we had really good sugar bag yarns.
Yeah, I bet.
Me, that was awesome.
And that was when you were trying to have the surprise for Megan, and you were getting stung trying to keep this surprise.
Yeah, I had a sugar bag dream last night. Just remembered it. Wow, I found sugar bag down here, and there just isn't sugar bag.
So explain what's sugar bag?
So native bees, they need like, you know, higher temperatures, so you don't find them in Victoria. They start in New South Wales and go right up to the north, and then up through New Guinea, Indonesia. You find them out on different islands, different Polynesian islands. You find them right out South America, South Africa. Same little tiny black bees, like smaller than flies, you know. And heaps of different species. But this is it's big story. It's really special lore around that my art and all the different ones. I found some once when I was like, because I've been coming down here for work for like a couple of months a year for, you know, a couple of decades, and one time like on the Yarra there, I found like a really big, old red gum. It wasn't red gum, it was Warren, that Managum. That's what Wurundjeri mobs name for that, you know. I found that tree, and there was a big sugar bag hive in there. And I went, oh, they have them here. But I haven't seen one ever since. And, you know, everyone says, no, there isn't that here. And even the scientists will say they're not here. But I'm like, no, it was there. I saw it. I saw that sugar bag hive. It was really huge inside this big tree. And there was like this tree root coming out in the riverbank. And at some stage, the tree root had grown around this rock. And so that for decades, maybe a century or whatever, this wood had been working on the rock and polished it, like, you know, and changed it into something that was in communion with that tree. And then, but also the rock had transformed the root. And that had just sort of cracked open. And so I got that one and just made that. I mean, it was perfectly smooth in the middle, so I just had to tidy it up a bit to make this really special bowl, you know, and you hold it and then you hold that rock and you put the rock inside it and it's just like humming and I'm like, oh, I don't belong here. What am I going to do with this? So I gave it to Ani Dyker and she started using it in some of the ceremony and stuff like that. Yeah. I mean, it's all communion, you know, and sex isn't a separate category from all that. It's like in it. It's in that creation, destruction, sort of cycle, balance, all that kind of thing, you know, sex and death. It's like...
Because you mentioned in the Dreamtime stories, there was lots of talk of sex and violence. And
yeah.
To kind of almost make it memorable.
Yeah.
Like just to make sure that these stories were passed through the generations.
Yeah. I mean, the children's storybook versions that you get of dreaming stories.
It's the PG rated.
It's just like, yeah. I mean, but there's all different versions. The deeper you go in the lore and the more you go through, you know, stuff. And it's like, and then, you know, and then they... took all these clitorises and stretched them out, made boomerangs, and you know, it was like,
wow,
hey,
what?
Look out. It's like, it's full on.
In terms of the way that these are like communicated, like at what point are you old enough to hear those versions of the stories where they start to become sexualized?
So there's
like adolescence.
It's kind of like every 10 or 15 years, there's new stages of initiation people go through. And there's a deep lore that sort of offsets the Chinese whispers effect of things people keep saying, oh, that's how myths develop. It's people keep telling it over and over and it changes every time. But there's no, you know, it's like the written Torah and the oral Torah with Jews, you know, there's no change in that lore. So there's really strong ritual states that you have to get in to memorize these massive bits of information, like bodies of knowledge, like word for word, like precisely. And that's in that deep ceremony, you know. And that's right story. But then there's the ways you elaborate on that knowledge outside of ceremony, you know, that's right story too, because you do that collectively. And within relations, it's like, you know, it's just like sex, there's rules, you know, and if you're just going around dory anybody or, you know, make up stories anyway, then false witness gossip, you know, those kind of stories, they got that bad intent and that hidden intent. What did we mention? Passive aggressive kind of stuff before. You know, there's that intent where you seem to be telling a good story about someone, but it's really insulting them. You're stirring up bad feeling. Wrong story can be like a curse, you know, because a curse for us is like a ritual action that makes an illusion affect reality. You know, so, you know, if you curse somebody, then you're creating an image of an illusory state of sickness or death or madness or whatever. Then you sort of jujitsu that around with you know, working with continuous motion flows in nature to power that up, and you basically, you know, partially through suggestion, partially through, you know, those sort of group, you know, embedded informatics that are in the landscape, you make that illusion start to affect reality.
And starts to feel
that
real.
Come sick. And it's hard to combat. That's why you got to have clever men who can do faster responses to that, because right story has that slow evolutionary cycle we were talking about before. So it takes longer. It's the same as like combating disinformation online now. The government's going, no, that's not true. This study actually says this, and that was like miss. You know, they didn't have any sources. They don't have a corrections policy. So, and they got no story, you know. And so, but like bad actors in the world, you know, coming out from, you know, China, Russia, you know, all these places. And of course, what the CIA and the US government's been doing for, you know, the last century, you know, they make these bad stories, wrong story. You know, they use it to sow discord, discontent, and they can do it real easily, just manipulate people
through
who
fear.
Are struggling, people who are vulnerable, real easy to radicalize them, much the same as I did with Sand Talk.
Yeah. And so do you feel like right story, wrong story, I've heard you share in podcasts, is sort of also looking a little bit back into where you were at when you wrote Sand Talk and your own sort of learning from that whole process and where your mind was at that time.
Oh, but from a side of struggle,
yeah,
you know, where I'm still, you know, like I'm mad and not mad, angry, but I'm a crazy fella and, you know, and I'm in a sort of deep, dark psychosis trying to make sense of the cognitive dissonance of, you know, suddenly realizing, oh, I'm deploying and weaponizing logical fallacies all the time to, you know, to make these false binaries happen and sort of, you know, put people in vulnerable emotional states and then force them to choose between, you know, good and evil, light and dark, old and new, you know.
But doesn't that just prove the point that it's so important for us to be able to share stories? Because if you're existing in an ecosystem where your story is heard, your story is listened to, our stories are heard, our stories are listened to, we actually ultimately will all be able to lift each other up in a way that the extremis of one story might kind of be a little bit kind of brought into the center.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, but I was in, you know, two communities. So most of the cultural stuff and lore that I talk about in Sand Talk, that's right story, you know, and that's coming from being in strong relation with communities and elders and knowledge keepers. But then also I was unwittingly in a community of kind of contrarian, libertarian, radicalized kind of, you know, Russia Today, bloody.
Yeah, okay.
Kind of, you know, propagandized kind of people going, you know, fuck Hillary. What she did in Libya, like, I hate her, you know? Yeah, but
a little bit red-pilled.
Yeah, completely red-pilled, like really edgelording around that and like, well, geoengineering's a thing, so, you know, yeah, I know chemtrails maybe, you know, why not talk to flat earthers, you know? Like until later you find out they don't really care about what shape the earth is. They're mostly, you know, want to talk about you know, IQ score distributions across different human populations. And, well, some people are suited to manual labor. And maybe we should get rid of these people. And
so what brought you back from the precipice? Do you feel that
Oh, and hating women. That's the other thing. You won't find a more misogynistic community than the flat earth community. And I was like, you know, no, I'm yarning with these people. That's our protocol. We talk to everybody. That's how we make right story. But it's a different information landscape now with everyone struggling from this, you know, individualized, self-branded, identitarian kind of politic. There, you know, it's just war. There's no good relation there, you know.
And getting co-opted.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Relationships are violent. Discourse is violent. Sex is violent. It's in hyper-individualized and, you know, and in faster and faster cycles of relationships. It's everything.
As Liam was about to ask before, what was the point where you started to sort of pull back from some of these ideas that you had when you were writing Sand Talk? Was it because you were like having people from certain community groups reaching out to you?
No. I was in the sound booth, like recording the audio book.
Yeah.
And I just went, oh, okay, I heard it. I heard it that time. All right. All right, I'm doing that. I'm one of these guys.
Right.
I'm a fucking, you know, ancient wisdom guru influencer is what I'm trying to be here. I got to step back from that because that's, that hurts people.
Yeah.
And then I got to clean up. And I tried to clean up with right story, wrong story, but I was like, I was just insane. I still am, you know, but, you know, I'm medicated now, like, because I actually got diagnosed after I finished the manuscript for that. So I didn't get really to talk much about the bipolar and psychosis and all that. So next book is going to be more, you know. So that book's trying to clean up the mess from that book. And then next book will be clean up the mess from that book.
Putting a little bow on top of it.
Yeah. And the next book will be Riot Story because I'm going to co-author it, you know, rather than, you know, Tyson Younger Porter even writing this book, you know. I'm going to co-author it.
Well, it's tricky, I imagine, as an author because you're kind of writing, especially something like Sand Talk, where you're kind of presenting your view. It's like it would be easy to imagine get a sense of like this grandiose, like this is my gift to the world. You know, whereas when you're co-authoring something, maybe there is that kind of push and pull where you might suggest something or, you know, your partner might suggest something and you go, oh, no, let's not push it that way. You know, it's more of a consensus kind of writing process.
That's it. Yeah. And that's why, I mean, that one's taken forever. You know, we've had a lot of yarns and recorded them, but it's been over a couple of years and, you know, we're only just starting to write it now. You know, there's a lot of tensions there, but those tensions are good because they're holding me in check a bit more. Because, I mean, that's a fucking mad book. Right story, wrong story. It's just
it moves around.
I mean, it moves so quickly. Man. I mean, I'm reading it and I'm like, wow, what are we on to next? Like, like, whoa.
And too fast. So it's still like, there's still wrong story, you know, because it's so quick and psychotic. And then, but at the same time, I'm like, you know what, you know, this, I gotta lay that bare and, you know, and that's a lot of these same patterns are in the world, you know, and seeing these things around me. So, you know, why not like push on the sore bit and see what comes out, you know?
I really respect the way that you share your work and you put it out into the world, but then you're not afraid to come back and to critique what you've said and to have another go at it and try and make sense of what you were trying to say or just let things go, you know, from Sand Talk. I mean, I personally really connect with that as a writer. You know, I started writing under the name Evolving Love Project because for me it's like there's no end. You know, I mean, I'm writing about relationships and non-monogamy. But, you know, it's from this perspective of it's this forever unfolding dynamic of conversation and learning from mistakes and, you know, having a shifted point of view. You know, it's like what worked for Liam and I 5 years ago and what I wrote about then, that's not where I'm at now.
Yeah.
You know, it's constantly a changing thing.
Because I imagine that you can unintentionally do wrong story. Like if you have good intentions, you know, potentially, is there a way for you to think that I guess all wrong story might actually be the intention is for it to be right story.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I think usually it's disingenuous.
Okay.
Or it's picking up on, you know, malware that's been installed by other disingenuous operators, like with Sand Talk, you know, there's right story there, but then there's also these little viral sort of algorithms installed from, you know, a lot of propaganda that I was consuming on YouTube at the time as well, you know. So it can become inflected with wrong story. I mean, wrong story can also just be right story that's in the wrong place. You know, you applying right story from one context into a context where it doesn't belong, you know, then you're stuffed, you know. You know, fluidities around being responsive to your context and shifting as your context shifts. Like that one big central thing in Sand Talk was that old fella there, Noel Nanapu, said, you know, if you don't move with the land will move you. And that's just it. That's just it in all your relationships, you know, is things shift and change, you know. I don't know, if you two ended up moving towards periods of exclusivity, it wouldn't mean you end this conversation here.
Absolutely.
Because that's just in response to a, you know, a situation, a context. You know, if with the fascist turns meaner, you know, you're going to have to, you know what I mean? If you're experiencing the same systemic hostility that me and my partner are experiencing, you might close the doors a bit, you know?
So what is that hostility? Can you explain some of that hostility that you feel in the broader context, like you're saying?
Yeah. So, I mean, we have you know, we're renting a course because who the fuck can afford a house? And I know there's a house inspection yesterday. Landlord and a real estate agent come around and inspect the house, and there's just that absolute, you know, terror of you know, this place has to be like a fucking hospital clean, like, you know, cause like one thing and you get reported and your kids will get taken, you know, and that's asymmetrical as well, because I don't care about that as much as, you know, Megan as a black woman, you know, cares about that, you know. Like, you know, our son Diver, he's named after his great grandfather who was abducted from the bush up near Pormpuraaw at the Mitchell River, and he tried to escape by diving into the Mitchell River. And he didn't speak English or have an English name, so they named him Diver Mitchell. So we named him Diver after that. You know, and it's kind of like there's that story, that cautionary tale there, you know.
So there's that intergenerational
trauma. Yeah, anytime you interact with any institutions, you know, police, hospital, anything like that, it's always that fear, you know.
Well, it's very real for you in ways. It's actually in your story. It's not it's not a made up thing or something that's incomprehensible. You know, for me and in my family, it's like I can't imagine, like it hasn't been a part of my story where children have been taken.
That's it. You know, that's it. I mean, we're just so precarious, you know. You know, there's you know, family members get murdered. You know, Megan's brothers, like he went missing last year. Like just went missing. His car's on the side of the road, he's gone. And we still can't find him. He's presumed dead, but you know, there's no closure there. So all these things are going, like, has somebody taken him? Did somebody, you know, kill him? Was he walking across someone's property and the dogs got him, and then they just like decided to just cover it up, bury him, like with there's a thousand, you know, trying to figure out all these things, you know. And I don't know, there's a kind of learned helplessness in all this, because you can do everything just right, you know, especially as an Aboriginal woman, you can do everything just right and still get flogged, you know. And so, you know, that's a couple of days of real tension in our house coming up for that inspection. And so there's kind of like you need to be this solid exclusive unit.
You know, just so monogamy exist, almost creates a shield. It's like you can control your relationship.
Yeah.
So if you can control that, then some of the other things that you can't control can kind of float around and, you know.
Then there's also just, it's not all bad stuff that drives that. It's also like we just happen to be like, you know, we found this late in our life, you know. You know, I was 45 and she was 40 when we met, you know. We'd already thought we'd finished all the kids and everything. But, you know, when we met, it was like bang, and the chemistry was just like heroin, you know. And it's still there. Like it's like everything else would be shit. It's like, do you want the heroin or do you want a cup of coffee? It's like, well, I don't want a cup of coffee. I want to get that heroin, you know. Yeah, it's like everything else is nothing.
Falling in love is like a drug addiction, you know, and the dopamine and all of the chemicals. It's
And you get past that 7-year cycle there too, which we recently passed. And, you know, and it's still there so strong. It's like, well, this is just what we do. I've been in a couple of times in my life, I've been in relationships, like longer term ones, where, like, you know, after about 6 months, my partner just goes, look, I'm just freaking, I'm just asexual, you know, I don't want to do this anymore, but I still want a monogamous relationship, so you're going to have to be celibate. You know, that's happened a couple of times in my life. And
that's tricky.
Comes down on you heavily, especially like as a young fella. I'm like, these are my fuck years. You know, and you lose decades into these things. And it's like, no. And then when it was like, I had 1 week of being polyamorous where we're talking about it. Like,
One week.
Yeah, I'm like, look, you know, so it's like, try. I gotta something, can we just, all right, we'll try, let's see how it goes. And like, I don't know, like I didn't have sex with anybody, but I'm just walking around, check it out now, you know, and I'll just, my depression just melted away and I'm like, you know, I'm thinking straight, I'm enormously creative in the world, you know, I feel good about everybody, I feel optimistic about the future. And then I come home, it's like, you know what, I changed my mind.
Oh, so your partner changed their mind.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm like, I missed my window. But I didn't miss the window. It was just being in the world as a sexual kind of person, you know? Mm. It's like, if you can't be that in your house, you know, then I should be able to walk down the street and just feel like it's like, you know.
Energy exchange.
Mm. Yeah. Like, yeah. Good little love eyes with people, like, you know.
Guilt-free love eyes.
Yeah.
I really connect with that. I think sometimes people can believe that non-monogamous people are always like, it's all like having sex all of the time you know, going out and looking for partners.
Yeah.
For me, it's actually what you just described.
Yeah,
it's like the openness. It feels like creative sort of energy channels might be open or something. That sounds a bit woo-woo, but just like a vibrancy and just like there's a feeling of possibility.
Yeah.
But then being in that position of choice to sort of act on it. Yeah. Or not is something I'm that I like really that. Connect with that. It's like there's an energy to that, whether or not there are other people coming in and out of the mix. And that's, you know, I think for me, it's like that's monogamy feels for me and, you know, I think for Liam, just like a little bit of a closed door on that.
I think it's because of the way it's structured.
Yeah.
You know, like I think in a lot of cultures it's not – it's not an oppressive patriarchal thing, you know what I mean? It's, I think if you iron out the asymmetries in there and you're able to live in a system that's asymmetrical but somehow tip it back the other way, then monogamy works, you know? But it's the asymmetries that happen with patriarchy. It's how everything's set up in the world for a man to walk around, you know, just this lone wolf like – you know, pillaging and et cetera around the place.
Yeah.
You know, taking what he wants. You know, their whole system is set up for that. And then, you know, there's just these hierarchies. In every house, it's like assumed you're going to be the, you know, the one on top as the male.
Head of the household.
Yeah. And so, I don't know, in patriarchy, what they did to monogamy was just crappy, you know. Yeah.
Looping back to what you said earlier, you mentioned the story of the older lady choosing a younger partner.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, isn't that the most beautiful response to like that standard narrative like patriarchy bullshit, you know?
And if you know that auntie, you know, she's got a beard and she's like, oh, I think I might get a new husband. You know, she just gets him. You know,
what happens to the first husband? Like, she just trades him out, or she just accumulates like a new lover? Like, what's happening?
It's the same as like, you know, I was telling you earlier, Mum Gladys, you know, was always Kinloch's wife in kinship, in the kinship system. They were never intimate, as far as I know.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't like that. And she could sit with Mum Hersey and they're sisters, you know, that way. And there's just that closeness there. You know, that's a relation that's there anyway. You know, and you know, it doesn't have to be sexual, you know, expressed in biological way, but it's, you know, it's still a sexual relation, you know?
Yeah. And then so does everyone within the community just go, okay, well, this is the thing now. You know, she's like got a new partner. He's like this younger guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Everyone's just like totally accepting.
But there's tensions with that too.
Yeah.
You know, I got a relation that's done that a few times. And a lot of people are like, oh, nah, like shaking their head. Like just because of, a power dynamic thing where maybe, you know.
Age differences.
A bit and young.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
I just
and
love
if you're like working in a TAFE or something
and
that's one of your students, it's like, you know, there's some stuff that's not working out there.
That's something that we've always spoken about as well, age differences in relationships and being aware of that.
Yeah.
And, you know, just also knowing that, you know, when people are, you know, they're coming into their sexuality and their adulthood, you know, that people can easily become so caught up with someone who is older and established and has a community of friends and, you know, is in the world in that way, and that there is that imbalance, you know. So we've always sort of been aware of that as well.
And historically speaking, has that always been the case that, you know, older people can take relation with younger people?
Yeah, I was lucky enough as a younger fella to have like a lot of like really like older women, like, you know, And I don't know, but then, all right, so when I'm 19 and I'm like dating a 50-year-old woman.
I love that for you.
All right. That, you know, that's, I learned so much about respect and, you know, and where to press and for how long and all that, which, you know, I was like, oh, okay. So, you know.
Love is as teachers.
Yeah. English is kind of, yeah, it kind of ruined any kind of technique for me. It's like if people say finger bang, I'm like completely doing it the wrong way, you know. but, you know, them older women teach you how to do that and teach you how to how to respect. It's just a long one, like, you know, all kinds of different shaped breasts and stuff like that and what they're for. Yeah, and you start to appreciate and get a different idea of beauty. So that's all right. But, you know, when I was 12 and then, you know, older woman then, you know, which was like, you know, I thought it was the best thing
at the time.
On earth at the time. And then later I find out, oh, that's actually fucked up all my relationships. That one. You know what I mean? There's
there was that power dynamic.
Yeah, context is everything. And it's so complex, you know?
Like, yeah.
It's so complex.
I really enjoy hearing, you know, about these age differences and the attractions with the older, you know, women that you would have had, you know, especially at 19. I feel like that feels comfortable and good, you know, with the lessons and the teachers, but also just going against, especially our sort of, you know, Western standards of beauty and like who is allowed to be sexual or not allowed to be sexual, or once you hit a certain age, you know, you should be like closed, you know, closed off in that way. And that's one of the things that it actually makes me think of Liam, because Liam has always had this attraction for like older women.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's really fascinating because for me, that actually brings such a sense of security for myself, because I don't feel like you're this person who is like forever chasing youth, especially being in like a non-monogamous relationship, you know, as a woman who's going to be growing and maturing and aging, you know, in the world, you know, I don't feel like I'm going to get cycled out. Like, it's very important for me that you feel a sexual attraction to older women.
Yeah.
There are kind of like asymmetries in that old young man woman relation that kind of, they should balance and cancel each other out. But there's some of it, you like, when you think back, there's a kind of guilt and a wistfulness kind of thing comes with the realization that you didn't really care about them as much as they cared about you. Like as a young fellow, and you just don't have that capacity. You learn to care, but it's like she's training you up for some other younger woman to benefit, you know, or someone next woman down the track to benefit from all the work she's putting into you.
It's almost like
she gets the benefit of like, man, I get this vigorous young dude and I can train him up. So he's not doing anything for anybody else's body. I'm like teaching him for my patterns and my pleasure. And so there's that. And then there's that power dynamic there. But then ultimately there's that thing. You will leave. You know, or she will die. You know, like there's that asymmetry there.
And because how much discussion is there within kind of First Nations culture around like the link between sexuality and death? Like, is it seen as this kind of like circle almost of like birth, death? Like, is it seen like that?
A lot of ideas about, you know, ritual stuff and, you know, stuff that would be seen as more pagan kind of stuff. A lot of that's kind of restoried as sorcery, black magic, or, you know, perversion. Now, in a lot of communities, and you won't find any community that is not touched by that, you know. So it's kind of different now. But that, like, you know, that old auntie's taking a young fella, that's going to happen forever. But, I mean, because there's such a, I don't know, it doesn't happen so much with old fellas and young women, like it does in some remote communities, but, you know, not much, because that's, you know, kind of demonizes pedophilia.
Right.
You know, and you just, I don't know, you just never know when somebody's like just going, no. You know, that's traditional law I'm allowed to do, and like just bending that for some fetishized experience, or that they're trying to excuse, you know, like a really dodgy, you know, absence of consent, like real consent there, like perverting the law for that.
Saying it's part of the culture.
Yeah, but you can't challenge that offal either, you know, and it's a tricky one. I did one time, you know, there was this old sorcerer up in Gulf country there, and he was like real old, like, you know, 70, 80 or whatever, but he was lusting after this this young girl that me and another fella called Baru, we were in kind of a sibling relation with her. That's just how it had come out from the other relationships around us. And so we were protecting her from him. And we were just, we called him out, said, no, yeah, that's bull. You don't get to talk to her because you're just going to, you know, try and bend her around, you know, for you. You got a bad intent there. And he went really mad, and he sort of grabbed his spears and his two wives and went off into the bush sort of yelling about us. And he's going to curse us. And like he did, he had this whole magics where he worked with lightning, you know. And yeah, so he cursed us. And a week later, we're in, he was up in Derby and I was down in New South Wales. And we both had a car accident at the same time. Like same minute, same second. He died, I survived.
Oh my goodness.
The car didn't, it was just fucked. But I was trapped in there for a good while. And like had to like climb out through all the glass, and I'm covered in blood. And yeah, and it was, he's working this storm, and I had to like try and find my way through all the bush to get home through this storm, and it was in a new place and I don't know what the fuck to do. Yeah, so I nearly didn't survive that.
Do you but feel that's like in that moment he, you know, with cursing you, he also cursed himself?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I don't know, but then there was all this other stuff. There's all this wrong story, twisted story around that, you know, about like you know, wrong story about magpie people, you know, being witches when that's not really what it was, what it's about. And this kind of like, I don't know, this kind of longing for the forbidden fruit or the danger of being with somebody like that. So there's all of this like really aggressive, you know, sexual behavior being directed towards this girl. And we're like, no, no, you know, she's somebody, you know, she's a person to be respected. She has, you know, more knowledge than all of us. And she keeps, you know, all this stuff. You, everyone got to respect her. You can't just be thrusting away towards her like that. And then, you know, other mob, like an adoptive mob that she was connected to, trying to control her and say, you know, the men there saying she's our property. And and then all this other stuff. And then that fellow was being really violent towards her. He finished up like, you know, in a wheelchair and then died. Like, you know, there was hyper death around that, the tumultuous sexual stuff that might be grounded in older, you know, things, but it doesn't necessarily follow that everything that's traditional is good. You know, there are like, there is always tragedy and always stories that unfold that end up echoing the cautionary tales of them old dreamings. Most dreaming stories about someone fucking someone they shouldn't. That's usually how they start. You look around you in the landscape, it's probably like, well, he fucked someone he shouldn't have fucked. Probably. That hill there, yeah, she was
right.
She went wrong way.
well, that's the thing that we notice. You know, we're talking about non-monogamy, you know, within the context of our marriage and our relationship. And that really sometimes shocks people.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm saying, well, the non-monogamy is happening.
Yeah.
Like, look around.
Yeah.
You know, this is, it's a part of the story. Like, everybody knows somebody who's had sex with someone they shouldn't.
That's it. And you got to have really good story to respond to wrong story stuff.
Yeah.
Like, you know, there's a wrong story of won't somebody think of the children, which I imagine gets thrown at you a fair bit.
Oh, yes. for sure.
What about the children? And you got to have good story for that coming through.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, like good story in response to that. But, you know.
Yeah, people always.
That's not going to change them where they're coming from. They're still going to keep doing that because it's a really simple thought-terminating cliche for gaining the moral high ground immediately.
Yeah, and I mean, it always has been, you know, for people who are of one culture marrying another culture, what about the children or people in the queer community, what about the children?
Yeah, and you know, what about the children our responses, of in, oh, but no, statistically it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and we get it too. You know, we've had people that have said, oh, you know, concerned about, you know, or I see it online or comments. It's like, oh, you know, I read one the other day. It was like, oh, so sad for their child that they're, you know, that for him or something. And, you know, I find that so interesting because it's like, you know, the health and the, you know, the functionality and just like the love within a family is all to do with the people who are involved in that family, you know, to keep the children safe. And it wouldn't matter what is, you know, whether you're monogamous or if you're from a queer family, it's like, you know, all sorts of things can happen in all different types of families, because there's all different types of people in different types of relationships.
Yeah.
You know, people who are Christian or people who are monogamous or polyamorous, you know, it really comes down to the people and the families within.
So a couple of names for you to follow up. There's Kim Tallbear. Like if you could get her, that'd be awesome. She's got heaps more knowledge from me. No, I think I've been in contact with her from when I've like recommended it to other people.
Yeah,
like,
cool.
Like the Stoa had her on one time, like the week after me, because I said, no, you got to talk to her. So I don't know, we're like 1 degree of separation there. But I never had any cause to like contact her directly. But there's also Mareka Bassani. So she's bummer, you know, my mob, like Cape York mob, and she she's doing a big Black Rainbow project because, you know, there's some real, like Cape York is still in the 1950s with a lot of attitudes towards queerness and all that kind of thing.
It's yep.
lots of suicide and all that sort of thing. Yeah. So, so she's, you know, she's got a lot of like really good stuff. She's a lawyer and scholar and has a lot of really good stuff around, you know, even, you know, polyamory and all different kinds of stuff going on.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so she's a queer scholar, got a lot of good stuff about trans business and, you know, knows a lot of how that fits into like traditional culture and then today culture and everything else. So, yeah, I could probably hook you up with her too.
Oh, amazing.
Tyson, we just want to say thank you so much. We are conscious of your time.
Oh, yeah. Got to get going.
But thank you so much for sharing this.
No worries.
Yeah, it's been amazing to meet you.
Yeah, it was a nice big yarn.
We could yarn all day, but we know you're a busy man.
No, totally could. Yeah, yeah. All right.
Thank you, mate.
Thank you so much.
That's it. That's a wrap.
Amazing.
Finish.
And the clap.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, that was good. Like I felt
beautiful person.
Comfortable to share some things.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thanks for sharing your own personal experience.
Yeah.
So
I didn't get into my Jason Momoa thing, but
oh shit. Jason Momoa thing, huh?
Yeah.
That could be take 2. That's right.
Yeah. That can be for next time.
Yeah.
Thanks for tuning in to the Evolving Love podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to hit the subscribe button and leave a comment on your favorite podcast platform. Your feedback and support fuels our passion, and together we're building a community of curiosity, kindness, and growth.
If you would like to show your support and are interested in accessing 2 extra podcast episodes each month, along with access to my exclusive writing, you can become a premium subscriber over at evolvingloveproject.substack.com. Subscribe, comment, and let's keep the conversation going.